From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The documentary film, This Ain't No Mouse Music, is a profile of Chris Strockowitz. He's the founder of Arhuli Records, a passionate music lover and collector who traveled deep into America's rural communities beginning in the 60s to record the music he loved. In the film, radio producer Davia Nelson says, for as much music as Strockowitz loves, there's probably more music he hates.
And he loves to hate things. He hates with a passion. Somehow the word mouse is descriptive of all the things that Chris hates.
Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. We're screening This Ain't No Mouse Music next week. So we're talking about it today with the filmmakers and with Strockowitz himself about his love affair with music rooted in America. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So right away in the documentary film, This Ain't No Mouse Music, you get a sense that Chris Strockowitz is impatient. Not as interested sitting around talking about the music that he loves as much as just getting out there and hearing it and recording it. In the film, he's even impatient with the question of what it is he likes about a particular type of music. He says he can't pin it down. Either I like it or I don't, he says. The film is a profile of Strockowitz, how he arrived in this country from his native Germany, how he became transfixed by what you often hear referred to as roots music. It's blues and zydeco and conjunto. Strockowitz traveled to these rural places. He found the musicians. He recorded their music, and he sold it on the record label he started called Arhuli Records. You've probably heard of that. The film is the latest in our documentary series, and today in the program we're talking about it. This Ain't No Mouse Music. Again, we're going to be screening it next week. Today, the filmmakers will join us. Chris will, too. And we'll give you the details about the screening as we go along. Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling have produced and directed numerous films, both together and independently. This Ain't No Mouse Music is one of the films they made together, obviously. And we should mention that Chris Simon makes her home here in Salt Lake City. And they're joining us today. And Chris Simon, Maureen Gosling, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Chris Strockowitz is also with us. And we're going to be talking a lot about you, Chris. And welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, nice to be here. We got a hot day, though. It ain't cool out here.
Well, Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, I guess that's a good... impatient is where I started. It's going to be maybe a little difficult talking in front of Chris, but there it is reflected. I guess that do you think that really gets at the essence of Chris in many ways? Is he just wants to sort of get out there and do it, get engaged in it? That sense of impatient really comes through. It seems like a theme in the film.
Well, it's certainly a theme in dealing with Chris, and I mean, but I think it's also one of his powers because, you know, most of us listen to this great music or we might go to a concert, but Chris went out and got off his butt and went out there in the streets and found it, and that's due to impatience.
Yeah.
And passion.
And passion.
We can add, yes, and enthusiasm.
Well, it was a great hunt. I didn't have to shoot nothing. I just looked for music, and God, what a trip.
Yeah. Where did Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, what did you come across Chris Strockowitz, and at what point did you want to decide you wanted to make a film about him?
Well, I met Chris back in around 73 through Les Blank, who Chris Simon and I both were very close to. Chris was actually married to him, and we worked with Les each for about 20 years and doing sound recording, editing, assistant editing, producing, co-filmmaking with Les. And Chris Strockowitz was in Les's constellation. And when I moved to Berkeley as an assistant with Les onto Les Fronteras, we were in the building that Chris owned and above his record store. Mm. So we were very familiar with Chris for many years.
It took us a long time to figure out to make a film about him, though. I mean, we literally knew him at least 30 years before it dawned on us, basically at the same time, that, oh, gosh, look to your own backyard.
Yeah. What was the film you had in mind? I mean, what was the idea? Did you just a profile, or I mean, what was the story and at the beginning, and how did it evolve?
I would say, you know, Maureen and I don't usually work with a preconceived idea, so it's not like we had a story arc or a story in mind. I mean, the way we both work is to go out there, and we learned this from Les Blank, go out there, find out what's happening, and the story evolves as you're shooting. I mean, with Chris, of course, we knew the basics.
We knew about his incredible archive of photographs. Of course, we knew the treasure trove of music he recorded. So all of that was part of our footage, really, that we had access to, in addition to 100-plus hours that we shot. And it was, we knew that there were certain things we wanted to get in there, but we also knew that it was this impossible task because he just has recorded so many different genres of music, so many musicians, over a 50-year period. I mean, that's a huge thing to take on.
And we knew all these people, too. So it was kind of, happy trails for us, too. But Chris took us to Texas and New Orleans, and then we all went to Appalachia together. So, and that, one big adventure.
The big story begins in many ways with Chris coming to this country from as I mentioned earlier, from his native Germany. Chris Drockwitz, talk a little bit about when you first got here. I mean, I wonder, this was one of the most sort of powerful, I guess, things that happened to you was all of a sudden you were hearing this extraordinary, this amazing music. Do you remember a particular, first time you really noticed the power of that kind of music? I mean, what were your first experiences with that?
Well, a couple of them, I guess. I don't know. It was, of course, a very lucky stroke for me and my family that my mother's mother was an American. And this is the reason we actually got here, that a couple of great aunts pulled some heavy-duty strings in Washington, D.C. and got us in here. Which was really almost unheard of for Germans to be allowed to come into the United States. This was in 1947. But one of the first really cognizant moments, I think, of my being turned on by music was when my friend Bill Mellon and I went to see this movie called New Orleans. And in it is the entire Kid Ory band. You know Kid Ory, great trombone player from Louis Hutt, 5 Days, and it was a powerful band, and it was fronted by Louis Armstrong. And in the movie was also Billie Holiday, who played, of course, the maid in those days. And Meat Loaf Lewis was in it, a wonderful boogie-woogie piano player. And on our way back to the school, we went to a private school near Santa Barbara, and I asked Bill, what is that music we just heard? And he said, that's New Orleans jazz. Mm. And, oh, boy, that started Hunt number one records,
Yeah.
And they were scarce in those days. I remember a Bunk Johnson album of 4/78s, and it was George Lewis on clarinet. Oh, God, paradise.
You know what occurs to me? Do you have a photographic memory? I mean, all of the music you can recall. I mean, I imagined if I were to pull a record out of your collection, you'd be able to tell me a story about it, or many of them anyway. Is it a photographic memory, or is it just connected to the music? So it helps you remember all of that.
Well, it's connected to all three, to the music, to the people who were making the music, to the scenario that was there. I mean, some people go hunt big game in Africa and kill something. I don't have to kill nobody. I just got to catch them singing or playing. It's just a wonderful adventure, and I'd never encountered anything like it. I was born on a farm, and I was a very privileged farm boy, And it was just simply overtaken by all these sounds that I heard. Hillbilly music came next, and that was over XERB in Rosarito Beach in Baja California. And, of course, Southern California was loaded with Okies at the time, and that station catered to them Full Tilt. Yeah. Ah, yes, the Maddox Brothers and Rose, America's most colorful hillbilly band. With little sister Rose. Come on in here, little sister. Let me hear you.
He definitely remembers.
Gosh, he does. Chris Simon, Maureen Gosling. I'd read this profile of Chris Strachwitz, and this musicologist, a guy by the name of Richard Spotswood, talked about how a lot of Americans take music for granted, and that Chris, you know, having not been born here, didn't take it for granted. He saw it as something rare and delightful. And this is something you kind of pursue a little bit in the film, this idea of what it was like for him to come as an outsider and experience it. Talk about that if you would.
Well, I think, you know, I think for one thing that Americans were not cognizant of this type of music. And Chris really is the one that, or one of the people that brought it out to the general public. And, you know, in my mind, he really changed the world that way. It took an outsider to recognize what was next door to us.
Yeah, America sort of likes itself as being a classless society, but that's a bunch of BS. You know, you don't call them classes, but they certainly exist. And the white class was always number one. And in order to hear black music, for example, this was long before there was really full-time black radio. As I was very lucky to grow up at a time into this country in 47, 48, that there was a beginning of small two-hour segments licensed to somebody who would take it on. And I happened to listen to a guy named Hunter Hancock with his Harlem Matinee program in Los Angeles. And he played everything from bebop to blues, from rhythm to boogie. I forgot. It was just incredible.
And Wilson Savoy, the son of Mark Savoy and the Savoy Family Band, talks about how he was, you know, Cajun music was around him and his own father was a musician. And yet, like you said, he took it for granted and didn't really think about playing it. And when he saw Chris's enthusiasm when he would come to town and want to record his parents, and he did, you know, got really involved with the family. Suddenly, Wilson started to think, maybe there's something here, and maybe there's something else I can do with it. You know, he sort of added his own sort of more rocky sound or zydeco sound and boogie-woogie piano playing mixed in with Cajun music.
Mm. I want to play a clip from the film, which gets at this idea of Chris's perspective coming from another place. This is Mark Rubin we're going to hear. He's a bass player talking about the immigrant who can't go home and its influence, its effect on the music.
He's a great klezmer musician, too.
Is he? Good. Here's Mark Rubin from the film, This Ain't No Mouse Music.
I think by being an immigrant, not just an immigrant, but an immigrant who can't go home, you're constantly looking for that, what we call in Yiddish, that Hamish feeling. You're looking for that feeling of home and place. And if you can't get your own, then you can recognize it in other people and celebrate that.
I want to play. There's a lot of stories. That's what's great about this film is there's just a lot of these different stories that you tell. And the film tells early on the story of one of Chris's first encounters. Is it Navasota, Texas? Is that how it's pronounced?
That's correct.
Yep, Navasota, Texas. Mm-hmm. And this is where you find Chris Mance Lipscomb. This was one of the first... this is really one of your first big finds. Is that okay to put it that way?
Well, it was the first performer that we put out a record by, because Mac McCormick, an extraordinary folklorist from Houston, Texas, he really introduced me to Houston and Texas and all its subgenres that existed there and subclasses or whatever you want to call it. I was looking for Lightning Hopkins, and Sam Charters told me he lived in Houston, and Mac was involved with Lightning to some degree. And he decided, you know, let's go out in the countryside. We can find people like Lightning there. And we finally met this man named Tom Moore, who owns a huge plantation in Navasota. And there was a song recorded about him by Lightning Hopkins. That absolutely intrigued us. And are you going to play a clip from that, Tom Moore? Or?
Yeah, I am, actually. This is Man's Lipscomb.
Oh, good. That's a powerful protest song.
Well, maybe we should say something about that, Chris Strachwitz. I mean, you had to promise him, because he was nervous singing this song for you, getting to record it.
I mean, you know, he figured we were a bunch of white folks and they would like to hear a little bit of Shine On Harvest Moon and maybe St.
Right.
Louis Blues.
Yeah.
And then Mac, in his gruff voice, you know, he asked, well, how about this Tom Moore blues? And he said, oh, you want to hear the real stuff. And, of course, that was really a very subculture type of song. It was all about the bad things or the tempting things that Tom Moore would do for his hands, everything from whooping them to, you know, feeding them poorly to, however, bringing their women back if one ran off because, you know, he had the power to tell the head sheriff, listen, get this woman back, you know. I need this guy to stay on my plantation. And, you know, I didn't know anything about plantation life at that time. And I learned a lot, you know. I was never very good at learning from books, but I sure learned from talking to people and hearing their music and their stories and stuff. It was just a tremendous, tremendous delight, or a safari, if you wish.
Yeah. Here's another moment from the film, This Ain't No Mouse Music.
Ain't but one thing, see what I've done wrong. Move my family down on Tomo's farm.
See, if you really focus in on it, there's thorns on these rascals, and those people had to do nothing but pick and pick and pick, and you can see the vastness of this field without a shade tree in sight. That's what made the blues, huh?
Go to work in the morning, stop at 1 o'clock. Hold back during the time, but you sure can't hold back there. Stand on the levee with his spurs in his horse's flank.
On the way back to Houston, Mac said to me, you know, Chris, if you're going to start a record company, this ought to be the first one, because this man is an unbelievable find. What Lead Belly was for Alan Lomax, he said this would be for Arhuli Records, because this man has the whole history of this rural black culture in his head. Not just blues, but reels and children's songs and gospel songs and ballads. I mean, it was incredible. That man had all of that in his head, you know.
Try and listen now. I tried all night long. Didn't miss my loved one until she had gone.
There's a one of the most affecting moments, at least for me, Chris Simon, Maureen Gosling, I wanted you to talk about this moment, and I want to play this section, is the time when Chris Strachwitz is talking, he's telling a story about Mance Lipscomb, and he wasn't really aware, Chris, you weren't, about, you know, the Jim Crow laws, about segregation in the South, and... Let me play this story, if I could, first, because I think it was a really sort of powerful moment. Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, anything we need to say to sort of set this up or say anything about before we play this part?
Well, if that's what I'm thinking of, we're standing in the graveyard where Mance is buried, and we went to see his grave, and, you know, Chris was going to tell some stories, and then what came out next was just so affecting. I personally think it's one of the key moments in the film because it really reveals, you know, the depth of Chris's feeling towards the people that he worked with.
Oh, well, we had some weird experiences together, you know. At some cafe, I remember, I stopped out in West Texas. I said, let's go in and have something to eat. I'm really hungry. And so we went in there. We sat down at the counter together, and I told him, I got to go to the restroom real quick, like, and so I did, and when I came back from the restroom, he was gone. I finally asked the man, where'd the man next to me go? Oh, he may be in the kitchen. And so I went back in the kitchen, and there he was. And I said, how come, man, she had to go? Well, he said, you know, this is where we have to eat when we come to White Folks Cafe. And I took it. You know, this was before the end of segregation. Segregation was still the law of the land. And if I'd have made any trouble, I mean, I didn't even think about making trouble. You know, it was just, I figured, well, this is the way it is, you know. I wasn't particularly progressive in those days. I took the way things were, you know. And I got teed off, but what can you do? Yeah. Well, those things happen.
It's that silence at the end, really, that kind of says it all. Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, you first, because Chris struck was, I want to talk to you a little bit about that. But there's like a kind of a sense of regret and sadness in those last kind of reflections.
Yeah, he, you know, what he's pacing, he's obviously still upset.
Yeah.
He is 50 well, years later.
Yeah, it really was affecting, and it's, we don't have that, we don't like have this whole line of stories in the film, but that one is really poignant, and there's a lot of sort of intimation that it wasn't so easy going down, although he did seem to, just by being curious and interested, I think he broke through some barriers because people would think he was this, you know, was he the landlord, the narco agent, the cop coming to their neighborhood? But then he'd say, ooh, I just love this recording. Can I, where do you find, you know, it's yeah. Lightning Hopkins, where do you find, I just love it. I got his records.
Yeah.
Well, that was in Fort Worth.
Chris, was that?
Yes. You learned to be a detective, you know.
But what about that moment, though? I don't know. You feel a sense of regret or a sense of sadness about all of that, I guess, that you weren't really thinking about it at the time. Does that make you feel bad, I guess?
No. I mean, that was natural. You know, that was the way it was. And, you know, as a child, you don't question where you live, where you come from. It is what it is, you know? At least I never thought of... I don't think most children... They don't ask, why is this so? You know, that's the way it is.
You weren't a child then.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, we're all children to a certain degree when it comes to things you don't know much about.
But you were surprised, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. But I thought we were way out in West Texas. See, we used to drive back. I was driving back with him from Berkeley to Texas. Which he didn't really like at the end. He said, Chris, I'm sure glad I'm back home. I just about got tired of sticking my foot through the floorboard. I was in the Volkswagen bus I had at the time, you see, and he was sitting so close to the front. He was not used to that, poor man.
That's Chris Strockwitz. He is the founder and the president of Arhuli Records, the subject of the new documentary film, This Ain't No Mouse Music. Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling produced and directed the film. We're screening it next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. And you can get details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Chris and Maureen are joining us from a studio in Los Angeles, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series on documentary film, our series we're calling Through the Lens. The film we're talking about today is This Ain't No Mouse Music. We're going to be screening it next week, talking about it today. It's the profile of Chris Strockwitz. He's an immigrant to this country who fell in love with American roots music soon as he arrived, really. Founded a record label and released albums of blues, Mexican norteño, zydeco, hillbilly country, basically any authentic rootsy music that caught Chris's ear. He's joining us today. Chris is, along with the filmmakers Maureen Gosling and Chris Simon. And the film is called This Ain't No Mouse Music. I'll give you the details about the screening as we go along. They're joining us, Chris and Maureen, from a studio in Los Angeles. I want to play just right off the bat here another clip from the film. This is the musician Richard Thompson. Because the question comes up, what influence, what difference did it make that Chris was going out there collecting this music and catching this music, as he puts it, and how influential American music was around the world? Here's Richard Thompson from the film This Ain't No Mouse Music.
What people love about America is the culture. They love Hollywood, and they love the music. And so much of the music that people love around the world came from these rural communities in America, especially in the south of America. And if it wasn't for people like Chris going down and recording this stuff, we wouldn't know about it. And in some cases, it might have just disappeared out of cultural history.
Chris Truckwitz, but I've heard you also say that you weren't really thinking about preserving cultural history. You were just interested in recording music. Is that right?
I think that's pretty much... Yeah. You know, sure, I became cognizant of the fact that I was finding people that all of a sudden a larger group of especially Europeans were taking a strong interest in their not only in their music, but in their history and where they come from and so forth. And this was especially true to the fact that Paul Oliver joined me in 1960 along with his wife, Valerie, take a trip through the South. It was basically through Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi. And he was sent by the BBC, and I knew that was the world's best network, you know, and I was really taken in by the fact that he was assigned this task to document blues, not just the music, but to find out who these people are. And that really... that in combination with, you know, folkways, I was impressed by what Mo Ash was doing there and always documenting things. Most commercially issued, you know, of course, I was primarily interested in the 78s at that time, but LPs were beginning to pop up. But most of them that dealt with blues, like with Howling Wolf or Sonny Boy Williamson, you know, they would either have a pretty girl on the cover or a drunk in the street, and they didn't tell you much of anything on the back, except, oh, this old boy is known to be from so, you know, doing pretty good. His records are doing all right on the jukeboxes, you know, and so forth. But anyway, I was impressed by the fact that people were beginning to take a serious interest in this music. This was particularly true of the blues at that time. And later, I realized that in the way of Mexican-American music, there was just nobody doing nothing.
What Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, what effect do you think our Hooli records and people who were collecting music like Chris was in those days? Because one of the points the film makes is that this really changed American music forever. Can you talk about how? I mean, how that the influence of hearing this kind of music really changed the landscape of music, how it influenced so many musicians?
Well, I mean, there's so many examples. But for instance, all of a sudden you're hearing the Rolling Stones. Well, Richard Thompson tells this wonderful story that actually is not in the film, but it's about, you know, the power of waiting for an Arhuli record when he was a young man in England, in London, and he, you know, just would wait by the side of the record shop for the shipment to come in of the Arhulis. I mean, that's how passionate the Europeans were about the blues. And as we all know, I mean, influenced the Rolling Stones, Richard Thompson, the Fairport Convention. I mean, the list could go on and on, yeah. I'm sure. And, you know, so it really did change the rhythms. It changed the depth of the music, too, I think.
The other thing was that Bonnie Raitt talks about in the film too is the fact that people were starting to hear these musicians in folk festivals and music festivals. Mm. Chris had a lot to do with that, helping them get to folk festivals and also performing in small clubs in some of the bigger cities, like the Ash Grove in Los Angeles, for example. And that I know when I was growing up in the, you know, in the 60s and 70s, I started, you know, I would go to a club and maybe there would be Reverend Gary Davis, or there would be some one of these elder African-American singers that would not have showed up in a club like 10 years before. Mm. And suddenly these guys were coming out of the woodwork and we were getting to see them. And Bill Graham would program, you know, Lightning Hopkins playing before the Grateful Dead concert. And so it would be, you know, we got exposure and it was included in the musical landscape of what we were listening to. I mean, we were listening to Joan Baez, we were listening to the Rolling Stones, but we were also listening to Fred McDowell and Big Mama Thornton.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I also think that it helped revive those cultural traditions to some extent, to have the outside world pay attention to Cajun music, for instance. I mean, you know, that's a very powerful thing when you think of your music as something that's kind of, you know, not quite right or hidden, or it's not American enough, and then to have the American public pay attention to what's happening down in Cajun land, which, of course, it's flourishing now, but, you know, in the 60s, it wasn't.
Yeah.
So that helped bring it back.
There's a great story from the film. I want to play another clip here. Ry Cooder, the musician, he's terrific in the film, by the way. He's great.
Oh, yeah.
tells a lot of great stories. And this one, he talks about finding this record or hearing Big Joe Williams doing the song Sloppy Drunk, and just what effect it had on his life. It changed his life, really. You'll hear Ry Cooder in this clip, also Chris Drockwitz as well, from the film This Ain't No Mouse Music.
And, man, it was like, uh-oh, totally different aesthetic and something just violent and great about this. And right then I thought, there's a lot in this world I don't understand.
I cried, ooh-wee, baby, bring me one more half a pint.
He lived in this horrible hotel where nothing but winos and prostitutes worked, and apparently some woman pulled a knife on him, or he pulled a knife on her, you know, and so they arrested him and he got sent to Greystone. And when he cut that record that night down in Los Gatos, this was a few days after Bob Geddens had gotten his bail, he was just in such an emotional state, you know, and have a young kid like Ry Cooder hear that.
And I felt, and I can remember this very well, to be a musician and make this sound with yourself in this physical, strange, powerful way, just like pure energy, pure, just almost insanity. This is the way to live. This is the way to be.
You know, this is a good opportunity to say that one of the best parts of the film, Chris aside, is the music. Chris Simon and Maureen Gosling, talk about how important that is. I mean, because there are... We get to see big chunks of music, and it's an important, and in some way that seems unique. They're not just little snatches here. We get to see good bits of music. That seems an important part of this film, of course.
Yeah, it's sort of a combination. I mean, there, in some cases we had to just give little references to some of the other kinds of music that Chris recorded, but thankfully we were able to put in some longer performances, like Michael Doucet and David Doucet playing this wonderful piece, and this guy in New Orleans, Henry Youngblood, playing with a Treme brass band. You get to hear pretty much the whole song. Mm. And so it's, you know, it's tricky. You have to kind of find the balance in the editing of how to, you know, not to have too much but not too little. And definitely difficult when you have the catalog that we were dealing with the massive recordings that Chris has done, plus just the live stuff we were filming.
Well, one of the things that would happen while we were out there filming is every time we tried to film Chris, he would say, "Film the musicians." So, you know, we have a lot of fabulous music in this film, and in fact, Chris has just issued a 2-CD set that has full performances of the music from
great.
The film. So, you know, and there's 69 pieces of music in this film.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you count even the little pieces.
Yeah.
We had a lot of little, they're little tiny pieces too.
But they're important too.
Yes.
One of the things that comes up in the film, and Chris Strockwitz, I want to hear you talking about this. You fix this early in the film in the 60s when Chris is out there catching this music, recording this music. It was a time when people were starting, you know, these small record companies. This was before a lot of them had been taken over by these, you know, large corporate record companies. And but now we're in a different era. And you sort of come back around to this question of, I don't know, you seem pretty pessimistic about the future of music, at least in that, not in live music, because that's a point you make very clearly, but like record companies or record labels.
Well, that's right. Everybody knows the record business is finished. But I mean, there's more kids playing music today than ever before, I think, and playing more different varieties of music and mixing them together and all of that. I'm not sure if it's all fine and dandy, but that's the way it is. You got to take it as it comes. And so, you know, it was a wonderful business that lasted over 100 years, the record business. And it employed a lot of people and got a lot of musicians started. You know, in the beginning, I should always like to point out to so many of these rural musicians who wanted to come and make a record, it was really a meal ticket. You see, if they got on the jukeboxes in their local community, that was already one step so that people could hear them. And then radio started to play the stuff, and that became even more important. And so today, that's still going on, that if people can get on the radio, especially, let's say, if it's a regional Mexican station, then people are going to want to listen to that group. That's why Los Tigres del Norte, for example, they don't really care if people bootleg their records anymore. They say, at first they used to be really paranoid about that, but now they say the hell with it. It's if the people come to our concerts, that's where we're going to make our money. And records have always been that sort of thing.
I want to play another clip from Ry Cooder. It's another great story that he's telling about this idea that of what's happening in the digital age. And during this, you just imagine Ry with a cell phone to his ear, talking about the idea of whether music is receding, you know, in the digital age.
Now, for most folks, I think the music is receding. I know it is, and it's going back that way to a streaming background. Relegated to the streaming background, you see. And what's in the forefront then is me. Where are you now? I'm in the produce section. Oh, I'm in the meat department. Oh my God, what are you buying? Oh, I love those. Oh, that's great. Then we're, you know, I mean, my God. But you can't say to somebody, go back to what you used to do. If it fades, it fades. If it recedes, other things become more important.
That's right.
You're right there with him, right, Chris?
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that people are going to start buying records again.
Yeah. Well, but, here's... I think there was something that a man by the name of Joe Wilson says in the film. He talks about the fact that... and I wanted to hear you all talk about this because in the film you go to the Blue Ridge Mountains and we hear the music of there's a band of these young people called No Speed Limit, and it seems like in some way Chris Strockwitz that you're getting a lot of hope from young people that they're really engaged in this music, something that Joe Wilson mentions, that this is not endangered music. Young folks are playing it. They're playing it everywhere.
Yeah, if they get support, you know, and unfortunately, hey, you should play something by No Speed Limit. I hope you will, because that girl is just incredible. But the band broke up, and we didn't get
well,
them. We didn't get them the fame and fortune, you know. But it was the end of the record business, and, you know, it was just not happening any longer. And I must confess also that Arhuli was never really that great at promoting musicians, you know. I was just there to catch things. It was my hobby, like the late Ralph Gleason once told me, you know. He said, Chris, you don't have a record company. It's your hobby. You only record what you like. And that does present a problem because most of these musicians wanted to be promoted, you know. And in that regard, you got to give the Chess Brothers and the Bahari Brothers and all those guys that were making those incredible R&B records credit for doing that. That's the today, Bruce Iglauer, for example, he really promotes his Alligator records and the musicians. I was never very good at that. Sorry about that.
But I think that the music, you know, it lives on with her without making a living by it. I mean, if you go to these festivals, it is. Joe is right. It's mm-hmm. young people. And we're hoping that, you know, this film will help expose more young people and get them excited. It's the back porch thing around, you know, around sitting around with your friends playing music. That's where music really needs to be. That's the number one place.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there won't be.
And the other point that we'd like to make with the film is that there is plenty of no mouse music is alive and well in your community. It's there. And we've had a number of screenings of our film with live music as a component of it to sort of accentuate that idea. And like Davia Nelson said at the beginning, you know, it's the music of your neighbors and you just don't know it. So these musics do exist even in Salt Lake City and Chicago and Los Angeles, and they're there and there's a community that loves it and there are wonderful musicians that are trying to be heard in those communities.
This is one thing that's important to you, Chris Simon, Marian Gosling, that it is ultimately a movie about music. So it's not a bummer film, I think is how you put it. It's joyful. I mean, it's about the joy of music, I guess.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, if people don't walk out of there tapping their feet and jumping around and wondering where can we go to hear, you know, the music of our communities. And of course, Living Traditions Festival is a good place to start. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's, we failed, but so far, that's not a problem.
Yeah, people really do. It's kind of gratifying to sit in the theater and just kind of look at the audience and see people grinning and their heads going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it's also an experience. We sort of wanted it to be an experience rather than, you know, we could have easily made a film that where all these talking heads, these celebrities or people saying, oh, how great Chris is, he did this, he did that, and you see them all in a row validating what this guy did. But instead, we wanted people to actually experience the people, the music, Chris, and not everything is detailed, you know, we don't give a definition of what's Cajun music or what's Zydeco music because people have done that. And what we want people to do is be curious and also feel it. And it's, you know, different from a lot of documentaries these days, which are very, you know, serious and heavy and very important. But we also need this kind of thing as a release from all of that, as a reminder of the joys of life as well.
Yeah, just enjoy all kinds of sounds, different kinds of music. I would have never agreed to making this film with you guys if it had just been blah, 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 blah. You know, it had to be the music. And we only got some of it in, but we got some good stuff in there. And not all of it. You can't have all of it in one spoonful.
And we cut out a lot of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
And we cut out a lot of good music, too.
Yeah, yeah. No,
that's unfortunately.
Chris Simon and Marian Gosling produced and directed the new documentary film, This Ain't No Mouse Music. Chris Strockwitz, founder, of course, president of Arhuli Records, the subject of the film. We're screening it next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Chris Strockwitz, Chris Simon, and Marian Gosling, they're all going to be with us next Wednesday for the Q&A. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Chris, Maureen, thank you very much for being with us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And support your local radio station.
There you go.
That's right. This is a great
show. Better come and see the movie.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Michael Shea is our intern. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard. Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.